Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with my podcasting partner, Peter Rollins, who is a writer and a philosopher and a speaker. I myself do stand-up and digital comedy on a thing called The Valley Folk. Both of us are housemates, and we decided to start a podcast about how to live well and how to take weird things in life and look at them in a different way, often through psychoanalysis or different postmodern philosophies. Is that what you do?
Yeah, I do a little bit of that.
A little bit.
Haven't done very much of that,
And I like to bring things like mostly Wicca and crystals to the conversation in LA and sage burning, that kind of thing.
He has a lot of crystal skulls.
I have a lot of crystal skulls. Most of them are filled with vodka.
Yeah.
But that's beside the point. So anyway, this is a very fun podcast. We are doing our first live Fundamentalists on August 29th. Tickets are selling like hotcakes. You can get tickets at peterrollins.com. It is in Glendale, California, which is part of Los Angeles, California, at Central Avenue Church. And you can get those tickets and grab them now. It's going to be a great show. We're going to have comedy. We're going to have philosophy. We're going to be chatting. We're going to be doing a Q&A. We're going to have drinks. It's going to be a great deal. You can have some beer, some wine. Speaking of wine, if you would like to support the podcast, you can check out trywink.com/thefundamentalists or trywink.com/fundamentalists if you want to type less. And that's TRYWINC. And it is a wine club. If you would like to have really cool hipster looking bottles of wine that match your palate, you can check that out. You get $25 off your first order, and it helps us keep doing this so that we can send off the files. Oh, thank you. And Pete just ran to turn off the AC. Great move, because we're professionals here.
I did that quietly so that nobody would know.
Uh-huh.
And you just said it.
Oh, yeah. Full transparency.
Yeah.
Speaking of full transparency.
Oh, one thing, by the way.
Great.
Don't believe Elliot when he says the tickets are selling like hotcakes. They really are. Most of the time when someone says that, it's obviously a lie. But actually, they're doing okay. They keep on...
It is. It felt nice to say it and there be a little bit of truth to it.
Yeah, I
know. It's a new thing for me.
That's why I had to tell people not to believe you whenever you told the truth, because you're actually telling the truth.
Don't believe Elliot. He actually is... That's a funny Pete joke. That's a psychoanalysis joke, right?
It is, actually.
Speaking of psychoanalysis, and I want to bring this up because it happened right before the podcast. Well, two things. One is that before we're going to do this particular podcast is on the subject of weakness, which is going to be very exciting, and I can't wait to talk about it. But before we started, and I'm also under the weather, so if at some point I just run out of battery, I feel like right now I'm running on a battery, so I'm going to like wind down at some point, and if that happens, I'm sorry. You'll hear me... my energy will go down. But anyway, it just happened. There it is. Now I'm back to normal energy. But before we started the podcast, Pete was like, I have this story to tell. It's about this, and it relates to this. He was like, what do you think about that? And I was like, yeah, man, sounds good. And I didn't think anything of it, but then you were like, it sounds like you don't care at all. I was like, oh yeah, for sure, I don't care.
I could have literally said anything.
Yeah.
But you were very affirmative, going like, yeah, tell that story.
Very supportive, okay. Yeah. The second thing I want to talk about is you developed a tic. I do this all the time. I'll say something ironically and then it'll become embedded. Like I did that with bro for a while, and now I'll non-ironically say bro. I say dude all the time, but that's pretty normal. But you did it with a phrase called
in a sense
there's a,
and I just noticed that I think it only developed a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I didn't want you to say it or us to talk about it, because now people will go back maybe to the last podcast and have a drinking game and realize that they will get wasted on how many times I say that phrase.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So I forced people to have a good time.
Yeah.
I made people have a
first
party.
Time for everything.
Yeah, exactly. Never happened before.
But my girlfriend, actually, she was drinking water one day and ironically went, because she thought it would be a bit annoying. And she did it a couple of times. And now she has to stop herself from doing it.
Yeah.
Because she's...
That's why you shouldn't make fun of people. Not because it's mean, but because you're going to end up doing it.
Yeah, well, that's what some kids do in schools. You know the way, if your teacher has a tic, and every time they do the tic, the classroom just reinforces it by nodding their heads and looking interested. What you can do is you can increase the tic in the teacher so that they will, by the end of the year, be doing that action on a repetitive basis.
That's fun.
Yeah, so that's
there are so many alternatives to learning when you're in school. It's just ways to pass the time. But the funny
just destroy
thing
destroy people's lives very subtly.
The thing about this in a sense thing is that you wrote a note to yourself that says no in a sense, but you're a person who literally you do the whole like God is nowhere, God is now here difference. And that literally sounds like no innocence. And you're right. You wrote it down and you put it next to the thing for the podcast that we're doing called The Fundamentalists. You wrote a note to yourself that says no innocence.
That's, you know what? That brilliant. That is really good.
Yeah, you psychologically primed yourself on some unconscious level. You're either telling people that you lack innocence or you yourself feel too innocent and you're trying to break away from that.
Yeah, and you know, it might connect with some of the themes of today's podcast because I do want to tell the story of Phyllis and Aristotle, and it might have a connection with the laws of innocence.
There you go. Lots to unpack here, ladies and gentlemen, here on the Fundamentalist Podcast. By the way, sorry it's late. We didn't do it.
We didn't do one. I'm wondering whether, you know, basically our policy will be we'll try 9 times out of 10 to get something out every week and on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might be later in the week, and there'll be some times when we don't put one out because, in a sense, we do this because we. Oh, I did it. In a sense, there it is.
I can't wait. Now I'm only going to be listening for it.
We do this for enjoyment, for fun, and so it can never be for if we just don't feel it 1 week.
Yeah.
It's best just to go, no, we won't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's definitely
mostly true.
Yeah.
From a branding and business perspective, it's probably not the best thing, but it's okay. Any success
trying to make money and make a living, it's a bad idea.
But you're right. If it stops being fun, what happens sometimes, I think, is like we'll get busy and then I turn around and it's like a Saturday and it's like, okay, you know? And then it's like we have to stop everything and do it and it feels forced. And I think that's what, more so than the fun part, like I just don't like it when it's like, I guess we just got to do it because it's fun when we're doing it.
And it's also forced whenever it's like we have to think of a theme. Not a theme naturally arises. Like last week you were reading that book. This week, I don't know what happened, but whatever it was, I texted you the word weakness because something happened. It's like, oh, that would be a fun thing to talk about. And it feels like when it comes in a more spontaneous way, we enjoy it more.
Yep.
And yeah.
Absolutely. At some point, I'm going to get up and grab some water out of the fridge.
Okay. Well, you do that. I'll pretend it's not happening.
Perfect.
And we'll keep talking.
Okay. Because the last thing I want is for you to draw attention to something like that.
Yeah.
No innocence. So, okay. We're talking about weakness. I think that... Personally, I've never experienced weakness.
Yeah.
I've never had any lapses in judgment, and I've never felt like I was in any way not the most masculine, tough person in the world.
Whenever your entire life is a lapse of judgment, it's hard to kind of say what is a weakness in relation to that. Would a weakness be to not?
It takes a
to
certain,
do something right.
Yeah, it takes a certain level of strength to be as weak as I am.
Yes,
it's so fun, man. What a fun subject. So let's. I want to hear your hot take on weakness.
Hot take and weakness.
By the way, hot take is another term that I used to use ironically, and now I use non-ironically.
Ah, yeah. It is the difficulty of our generation is that irony is so a part of our kind of air we breathe that when does like driving your bicycle with two wheels, you know, what are those big wheeled bicycles called?
Like big wheels.
Big wheeled bicycles. When is that ironic, and when does that actually just become...
Right.
Non-ironic.
Yeah.
It's a terrible, scary thing.
It is. I think it's a very scary thing that's going to affect us for a very long time. But that's a different podcast.
Let's do irony 1 week.
Yeah.
Anyway, weakness.
Oh my God, the irony is, Anyway.
What got me thinking about this, I just remembered it. The reason why I texted you weakness is because I remembered this story from the 13th century.
You're so old.
I am so old. and it's about Phyllis and Aristotle. And Aristotle is way back in like 300 BC or whatever. But a story was around in the 13th century. And it's about him and this relationship with this woman, Phyllis.
I'm going to imagine Phyllis from The Office.
The Office. I've only seen the UK Office, the good one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, it is very good.
Yeah. I wonder whether Americans won't so much get the nuances of the British one and the British won't get the nuances of the American one because like so much of office life is kind of like you have to be in the culture to get the intricacies of it or whether that's not the case. I don't know.
The American version just became part of my generation. It's in our DNA. Like that show is, it became like The Office is what's on, I think, the background on in people's living rooms, like 90, it's like our parents. Like, it's like the comfort of home is what the office represents. Whereas if you look at it objectively on a joke by joke basis, maybe the British one is more funny in terms of whatever comedy, but Office is like a more...
Well, the British heart. Office would be hard to be that, because I think it's by definition very cringy, difficult comedy to watch. But I don't know if the American... I've only actually watched a couple of episodes, so it could be fantastic. But I'm wondering whether, you know, I think of things like Friends becoming more of a background family comedy because it's not difficult to watch. Whereas Same The Office Friends, is, The Office is difficult to watch, isn't it? Because it's a character who is unlikable and yet likable in their unlikability. Mm-hmm. They're an anti-hero.
You should watch more of The Office. We should do that.
Okay.
Because if you like Peep Show, I mean, obviously the British Office is closer to Peep Show, but the American Office, I think you'll see that it's not. It doesn't have that, like, discomfort with the unlikability.
Yeah.
Anyway, Phyllis is a character. She's she's an older woman who maybe is not the most attractive, and she's maybe not the brightest, and she's very funny. I'm going to imagine her and Aristotle.
This is the opposite of Phyllis. Phyllis is attractive and intelligent and conniving and very interesting.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Well, so the story is Aristotle is a tutor of Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great has a lover, and his lover is Phyllis. And at one point, Aristotle says to Alexander the Great, you know, you have got to cut Phyllis out of your life, right? You're neglecting your philosophy, you're neglecting your state responsibilities, and basically, you know, you're thinking more about her than you are about the country and your role and your job. And so Alexander the Great, you know, I think he talks to Phyllis about this, and Phyllis is annoyed. She's pissed off. And so what she does is one night she goes to Aristotle, and she kind of seduces him, and they're kind of playing games. And then he gets down on all fours, and she sits on top of him to ride him like a horse, right? And then at that moment, she shouts out, and Alexander the Great comes in. And basically, Aristotle is humiliated. So Phyllis basically just does this to humiliate him, and also to make a point that, you know, Aristotle is saying you have to think of the mind and think of reason and cut out desire and passions and all of that. And Phyllis, in a sense, was showing that that the passions and desire can overwhelm our reason. And so it is a bit of a tale about weakness, how no matter if we want to be rational and reasonable and be sensible and do the right thing, we have these weaknesses that kind of subvert everything, and ultimately we'll be humiliated by them and shown up by them.
Oh man, yeah. Fun.
And this is also in a sense the story. Thank you. I've done it already three times.
I know.
It's incredible. Yeah. Now, this is a good example of wanting what you do want.
Yeah.
Like, the more I try not to do it, the more I will probably end up doing it.
Because you're seeking innocence. Okay, cool.
Yeah, Samson and Delilah.
Yes.
In the Bible. You know, Samson has long hair. His one weakness is short hair. Delilah eventually figures it out. Cuts his hair off and he's weak. So that's just a story of, in a sense, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's a story of somebody finding the weakness of the other. The one thing in their life that will reduce them to kind of impotence.
Right.
And in psychoanalysis, it's called objet putier, the small object A. And small object A, think of A as an algebraic term. Mm-hmm. As in, you know, an algebra letter stands in for an unknown number.
Variable, yeah.
We all have small objects that we don't really know what they are, but the small object A is this thing in our life, whether it's having a baby or getting a certain job or going out with a certain person, this small thing, and actually can be the way hair drops. It can be something a person wears, the tone of voice that just absolutely gets you. Like, oh my goodness, you know, it really kind of gets you. And it's the small object A is the thing that causes, I think, humans to be weak. That's what weakness, I think, means. Because dogs aren't weak. Other animals aren't weak. Humans are weak in the sense that we pursue things that will destroy our stability and the entire constellation of our world. And it can be the smallest thing. You can meet a woman or a man who speaks in a certain way that just you're willing to destroy your entire life for. Object A.
Object A.
And,
yeah.
And a lot of analysis is working out what your object A is.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. To say that it's weak is to imply that the alternative is strong, which is to a good thing. So the alternative of weakness, you're saying, is kind of inevitable. Like, you're basically saying that there's no, like, strength almost seems like the ability to withstand weakness, but you're saying that weakness will always prevail in some way.
In some way, this, like, there's weakness of eating chocolate when you do want to. That's a very natural, mundane weakness. So I'm not really talking so much about that. I'm talking about this. You have this very human type of weakness for something very inconsequential that we would burn our lives down for.
Yeah.
And
the seduction part is interesting because I always forget that that's a thing. That, like, women, and this is obviously me speaking from my vantage point as a, you know, straight male, I forget that women have the ability to seduce me, and I've seen it happen, and it's interesting.
You're just hoping that someday it will happen.
I'm hoping.
You're hoping a woman will one day try to do it.
For the love of God. But there's been moments when I've been like caught up in the past and been like, oh, this person seems rich. And then I'm like, oh, this is intentional. Like, this, and it's such a probably result of being naive in some way. But then when you see it, there can be a little bit of like a not a malicious intent to it. But in my personal experience, there have been times when that type of seduction has come with a little bit of like darkness in it.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting, I don't know how to describe that necessarily, but it's
a lot of seduction. Is around this idea of object A. So a man or a woman can get a lot out of being the seducer, trying to seduce. That can be their object A. Someone is like, they just love the chase. Mm-hmm. They're obsessed with kind of winning someone over. But as soon as they win someone over, they're not interested. So maybe they've got a stable relationship. They're in a loving family. But they just love to go out there and to evoke the desire of the other.
Mm-hmm.
By evoking the desire of the other, they feel powerful. And it's nothing to do with the other. That's the thing about object A. It's also, it's similar to what's called a partial object, which means you don't desire the man or the woman. You desire some partial feature of them. So, it's the love of the chase. But as soon as you get the person, you're not interested because you don't really desire them. You desire something that they represent.
Yeah, there's some kind of terrifying... that whole idea is so depressing to me. There's something so sad about being like... The idea of constant chasing and constant being like, this is what it's about. It's really about... It's all about the chase and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, it is. And I think the reason that I find it so sad is because I know that there's truth in that. Yeah. And that's not fun.
And it's very painful for the people who are involved. I feel bad sometimes for people who are obsessive and therefore, you know, always going out for the chase. But then as soon as they get the person they are seeking, they no longer desire them.
Sure.
Right. So that's it. For the obsessive, they go out, they do all of this work to win over the other. And as soon as they win over the other, they lose interest. That's it. It's actually very difficult for an obsessive because it's very hard for them to get an intimate relationship that lasts. It's a kind of painful thing. And then, of course, on the other side, there are people who just enjoy being desired.
Yeah.
So as soon as in one sense, they're in a mundane relationship where desire becomes something else, they lose interest because their object A is being desired, being a god or a goddess to someone else. And so whenever that disappears, they lose interest. And that's painful as well.
And that's what we do here. We like to have a good time on The Fundamentalists. We like to spin things in a way that's positive and optimistic. So back to the subject more acutely, I guess, of weakness and the idea of weakness. So to make sure that I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
you're saying that there is this lowercase a, mm-hmm. that is the variable, the thing that is the hole in our armor.
Yeah.
and the thing that makes us like unable to withstand. And you're saying it could be something super specific, but in terms of weakness as a whole, people are living their lives and they're like, I want to be a strong person. I think this is a very interesting conversation as it relates particularly to masculinity, because masculinity these days is a very kind of convoluted idea, because we're in an era where all of those terms are being sort of deconstructed and reconstructed and sort of seen through a different light. But when you say weakness, in my mind as a young man, or I like to think young, I like to strive for strength and strive for like stoicism and strive for like, you know, that is this and that is that. It's like the person in the story who's like, you need to let Phyllis go because you know, you're neglecting your responsibilities. And there's this part of me that's like, what a beautiful thing to even think, like, yeah. What a nice idealistic thing to think that your responsibilities would ever in any way trump your being seduced by Phyllis. Like, in my mind, that just is like a non, like, it almost seems like more of a fantasy to be like, oh, you're really gonna give up the lady so that you can go do your work. Like, that's a that seems to me to be this such a strong move, but you're yeah. saying that like that's just not gonna happen. Like,
and actually even worse than that, the more you have a law that says don't do something, so the stronger a person tries to be, the more the transgression becomes attractive. So the more you fight against your temptations and your weaknesses, the more you feed them, and then the more at some stage something's going to happen. Either you'll erupt and do the thing, or it'll come out in some other negative way. So weirdly, the more that you have a law saying don't do this thing,
yeah.
the more you want to transgress the law.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. No, that makes a lot
but
of sense.
There are ways out of this. So here's a true example I read about recently. There's a woman in therapy, and she was sleeping around, and she felt guilty about it. She was like, you know, it's not what I want to do. It's not what my family would want me to do. You know, I feel judged by my friends, all of that. So she felt guilty, but she was going out the weekend, and quite often she would be in a one-night stand with somebody, and she was talking to a therapist about it. And basically, in her head, she was thinking, well, at least I feel guilty about it. Because if I didn't feel guilty about it, I would probably do this even more. Mm-hmm. Right? I would be out every night of the week. So the guilt is stopping me from sleeping around even more. But what happened is the therapist started to look at the guilt. And as they kind of worked through the guilt and she stopped feeling guilty, so did her desire to just have these one-night stands. So weirdly, the guilt that she thought was stopping her from going out more and sleeping with more people was the very thing that was feeding the desire. So as she got rid of the prohibition, right, she got rid of the desire to transgress the prohibition. And then, you know, she can still go out and do whatever she wants, but now it's not this frenetic kind of self-destructive behavior. Which means it's not about, by the way, it's not about getting rid of your object A. It's about finding healthy ways to navigate it.
That's yeah, it. I've been talking with a lot of my friends about this, and it's not speaking of my friends. Lee Newton is calling me, but I'm not going to pick that up currently. Yeah, the idea of like you don't give, like, I don't. There's very few things I've like given up wholeheartedly, like in my experience. So full disclosure, I've done in my life, I did one time, I was in New York City. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I was at a comedy club. Mm-hmm. And I did a set of stand-up comedy, and this is going to shock you, Pete. It went well.
Wow. Yeah.
It went all right. Yeah. And so
yes, more believable.
Yeah, it was
fine. It was really bad.
They were really good comics on the show. I felt like I held my own, but I was happy to be involved. So anyway, I ended up doing a narcotic, which I will not say the name of. All right.
I feel like I should do a citizen's arrest.
Yeah, I should do a citizen's arrest. It's pretty bad. But I did. It was like one of those things where I was like, I felt like I was in just the most kind of stereotypical and also oddly beautiful scenario of like, I was with my friends. Some of them were like friends from Los Angeles and some of them were friends from back home in Florida. And I was in New York City for the first time. I had just done stand-up set. I was upstairs at a comedy club, blah, blah. All the stars were aligning for me to make bad decisions. And of course I made some bad decisions. So anyway, I do this narcotic. I won't tell you what it is, but let's say it wasn't Pepsi. And so I did some Pepsi and I was like, oh, okay, get it. Got it. Good. And I felt terrible after it was done. I felt incredibly guilty after it was done. I was like, oh, I never should have done that. I'm never going to do it again. And the next day I was felt very low and very kind of like, I can't believe what a horrible, you know, person that I am for engaging in that. What I told myself as a kid, I would never do anything like that, blah, blah, blah. So I did it. And since then, it's like one of those things where it's like, I don't tell myself that I'm never going to do it again. Yeah. In fact, I constantly joke that I'm going to do it at some point. And I don't know that I'm going to. But at the same time, I don't fall into... Something clicked. I don't know if it's like part of growing up or whatever, or it's part of in some way like rebelling. If you are in more of like the fundamentalists, literally the fundamentalists world, then it can be considered a sort of backsliding or whatever. But I really think it's a type of progression when you take the stigma away from these things that you previously completely prohibited. And as a result of taking that stigma away, I do feel in my personal experience that it does just make it, it makes life lighter to deal with.
Remember, the Hound Tull podcast I did and you were there. Moshe Kasher. On that panel, one of the guys said, interestingly, he was mostly, he was pretty far gone.
And not
that engaged, but he was very funny guy, really nice guy. And a couple of times he just said some really interesting things. And one of the times he said, I was doing analysis and he said, I was talking about, I was married, I was talking about affairs. And my analyst said, well, don't take an affair off the table.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, what do you mean? And the analyst didn't explain, because the analysts don't do that. But what the analyst was kind of saying to him is, if you put an affair off the table, it just makes it even more desirable. It makes it something you really want to do. Whereas if you keep it on the table and we discuss it and we look at it and you kind of, you make it, you normalize it to the extent that actually you're less likely to do it. You know? And you're more likely to, you know, work something out with your partner, whatever that is, but you're more likely to do it in a way that doesn't destroy the fabric of your social life.
You're more likely to do it in a way that doesn't blow up your entire life.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what the object is. It's like at its worst, it can at its worst blow up, it rip apart the fabric of our existence.
Oh, fascinating stuff. But yeah, it's an interesting role. And so it's a thing where it's like, it's the same thing with, weaknesses that I have. Because I'm working on this this book of, well, it's just a book, but it's basically like one of the chapters in it is talking about this subject. It's talking about kind of the release valves that I tend to do to make sure that like I am able to live the life I want to live, but I also like don't want to get so stingy with things and so like I've learned that like I used to think for a while. Sorry. I'm a little under the weather. And as a result, it hurts to swallow. So saliva ends up building up and it's really gross. But anyway, I'm sure everybody wanted me to share that. But anyway, one of the things, I forget what I was talking about. The different moves. I used to think that I wanted to be this like very zen kind of like, you know, I have elevated beyond these desires, that kind of like Buddhist thing that you can surpass your desires and give up those attachments. And I feel like I maybe almost went too zen for a little bit, where it was like I gave up the certain attachments that I had to like many things that would be healthy attachments to have and healthy desires to have, that if I took them too seriously would be weaknesses, such as things tied to success and financial freedom and gaining money and getting rich and all that. And it's like I gave up that stuff in this sort of like pseudo zen way, and it's like no, like I want to be engaged in life in a way that's not so detached from it.
Yeah, I mean that's the what happens when we get so caught up in weakness, self-destructive behavior, is we tend to go one of two directions. One is we try to get rid of desire, which is kind of like that pseudo Zen Westernized Buddhism route, or we get very attached to the belief that we can have the thing that will satisfy us, make us whole in a healthy way, which is kind of westernized religion. But the interesting thing for me is how do you actually just have a healthier relationship to your object, eh? Not get, because it's what makes life worth living. Without this kind of excessive attachment to something, which is called love. I mean, love is the excessive attachment to a mundane thing that to you doesn't seem mundane at all. Without love, life is just a nothing. It's just like you're just walking through life like a cow grazing on grass. You know, it's like there's nothing that attaches you. And actually what makes life enjoyable and painful at the same time is love, the excessive attachment to something.
I was going through some kind of something and, you know, some kind of like, nothing bad, but it was some typical thing. And a married friend of mine was like, I'm really glad I don't have to deal with what you're going through because I'm, you know, I'm...
Is this about the rash?
Married, yeah, it was the rash thing. And look, I was... Was it painful? Yes, but
was it embarrassing? Yes.
Should I have worn pants to, you know, should I hit it? But anyway, giving stuff away. But anyway, he was like saying, you know, I don't have to deal with it. And I was like, oh no, dude. I was like, this is better. Like the pain and the like the struggle of it and the what and finding that like object A or whatever. Because I don't know what my I don't think I know what my object A is, which I'm sure we can is a separate. Subject in and of itself, but like finding that and being like, oh, there's the stuff, and I see it in glimpses of things, and I can feel it where it's like, oh, okay, oh, this is like there's a thing. It's not like it's like an ice pick into your brain when it like comes across, and you're like, oh, there's been times, excuse me, where I've just been like, what choice do I have? Like, I feel like that is the that's whatever the object A is when you end up going like. If it's a person, if it's a certain type of person or a certain relationship or dynamic, there's been moments where it's like, I am powerless in this situation as whatever. And that can be an excuse and you can be like, you're never powerless. Like you can always rise up and like, do. And it's like, nope, like whatever. No, you can't. Like for sure. Maybe. And if the observer saying that was in my particular situation, maybe they could surpass it because it wasn't their object day. But every person, like I get very, frustrated with that sort of like pseudo manly, like, no man, like you rise up, like you do. It's like,
well, because it'll come out in some other way, because you know, you can, of course you can, through sheer force of will, kind of move away from certain things, but if you haven't worked through it, it's just going to come back as a stomach ulcer or a heart attack or another unhealthy behavior. It's like alcoholics who give up alcohol but you know haven't worked through why, and then are addicted to smoking or fitness or you know Pepsi or whatever. You know,
but you would call that like a version of sublimation, right? If you were like working out,
well
are you talking about to the point that you're
to the like, point it depends if really, sublimation would be sublimation would be if you've taken that and you're working out, you're fit, you're healthy, but if you're obsessively working out, then that would just be displacement, really.
Interesting. Cool. I get it. Back to the subject of weakness. Do you feel yourself that you like, do you feel that there are weak people and strong people? Do you feel that there are weak people who become so obsessed with the object A that they are inherently weak individuals?
I don't think so. Say it again. Go
basically like
revolve around again.
When you look at humans and they're all out scurrying, some of them are like, I have responsibilities. I focus on my responsibilities. I have a job. I'm making a business. That is what I do. And then every now and then on a Friday night, on a Saturday night, this weakness pops up, flares up. I don't prohibit it, but I don't let it rule my life. There are others who every night out and about, whatever that object A is, let's office reruns, and they can't get enough of the office reruns, and they watch it all day, and they, you know, maybe get some work done in between, but they're all about the office reruns. Would you say that that is an inherently weak person? Peter Rollins, would you say, asking it so officially, would you say that, but would you?
I would say that that person is engaged in self-destructive behavior. So in a sense, weak, but I would say we all have that potential, but if some of us at some points in our lives, we give ourselves over to the destruction of our lives. And, Yeah, that's everywhere. So yeah, you want to call that weakness, but it's a symbol of a weakness in us all.
Yeah,
but by the grace of God, you know, we're all pretty. You know, they say like we're all a few paychecks away from homelessness.
Yeah,
we're probably a few experiences away from burning our lives.
Yeah, I'm like a few paychecks and bad parenting away from a lot more not Pepsi.
Yeah, yep.
Anyway, so not to like cut this short, but in the realm of weakness, do you see those batteries right there?
Uh huh.
I forgot
to put them into
The thing. Yeah, so we could go out at any moment.
Okay.
And I don't want that to happen.
Right.
So are there any subjects that you want, or any topics related to weakness that you want to try to blow through? And I'm sorry to our listeners. I know it's a shorter one, but here we are.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I wanted to cover this idea of object. There is another element, which is would be fun to just talk about quickly.
Let's hear it.
Which is that the object A, this small thing, the way a person's hair falls, that way someone looks at you, whatever, it's that little tiny minuscule, that's why it's called little object A. It's tiny. In fact, it's so tiny, it's barely perceptible.
Tan lines.
What's that? Tram lines, did you say?
Tan lines.
Tan lines.
It's like a thing that I have.
Is that your thing? Do you
think? It's like one of the things.
Is that right?
Yeah, I really like when I don't know if it's from being from Florida.
Or I have tan lines.
Yeah, I don't think they look great on you. Okay, they look great on you. Yeah. I guess it does. The tan lines have to come attached to
some other
someone
that
I may find attractive. But yeah, when a girl has like tan lines from being out on the beach or something or out by the pool, I think it's an attractive thing.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, I've never thought of it. Very nice.
It's a fun little unique, like, it's
well, that's
awesome.
A great example of, because it's not about necessarily the woman or whatever, but it's a tiny, almost imperceptible thing. Like, I would never have thought of that, but when now I think about it, I go like, oh yeah, tan lines, it's a very small thing that I don't think about, but you see and you're like, oh, that's really attractive.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the small object A, but in a sense, these things are given to us by something else. And the example of this is what's called the mirror phase. When a baby looks in the mirror and they see themselves in the mirror, there's a certain point a few months old where they recognize themselves. But what happens is the child looks back at their, say, mother or their father, and they see their mother or their father's excitement. And they go, that's you in the mirror. Look at that. That's you in the mirror. And you start to enjoy your own image because the other is enjoying it. So we learn very early on that to enjoy what the other enjoys. So that's why we can sometimes enjoy what we don't enjoy. We can desire what we don't desire.
This is why you watch YouTube videos.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you hang out with me too much.
I do. It's terrible. And I know all about Fousey.
Yeah.
Fousey. And
have you seen his newest thing?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've been out of the loop for a while.
I smile because, and I don't mean to smile and like make light of it, because clearly he's going through something, but he basically changed his name to Rose and he wrote himself a check for $1 million or something. He's just doing
it. And it's terrible to talk about. She'd never like, you know what?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, someone's psychological position because you don't know them.
Yeah.
But sadly, I think it is a good example of what a psychotic break looks
there's
like.
There's some indicative, so yeah.
That
some.
Was what was interesting to me. Is like, and it's very sad as well, because I'm going like, whenever you have a psychotic break, I have a friend, actually, he was very well known, and he was in the political sphere. He was doing some very big grassroots stuff. He was on Oprah and all of that, and he had a psychotic break and ended up very publicly doing something. This is a number of years ago. It's a lot of people will know about it. It's not
I know
a big
exactly
secret.
What you're talking about.
All right, yeah.
I didn't know. That's funny. I didn't know you know.
Haven't seen him for a while, but yeah, he's a really good guy. But it was a psychotic break. But when you have a psychotic break and you are famous and you've got millions of people watching you, I mean, that's
for a good thing. He was famous for.
Oh yeah,
a good
he was
thing.
Famous for trying to do something really good.
Yeah.
But and he has a sense of humor about it because it was literally a psychotic break. But but you're doing it in front of millions.
Yeah.
And that's terrible.
It's one of those things where it's like you don't want to armchair diagnose somebody. But at the same time, it's like when people are like, oh, there were no signs. It's like, well, in this case, there's signs. So it's like there are signs currently that this person is going through its things. Anyway, to make light of it is dark, but it's also just incredibly fascinating. So anyway, the mirror phase, you look in the mirror, you're like, oh, that whatever that is good. And that's how you sort of develop a sense of
Well, one of your earliest objects of object A is your own image, your own self, which is reified by someone else. Think of it like Instagram. You know, when people take selfies, a selfie's always for other people. You know, you don't just keep your selfies to yourself. That would be weird. So you share them and people like them. And what attaches you more to your own self-image is the more likes you get. So if you put up a picture and nobody likes it, your fascination with your own mirror image will be minimal. But if lots of people like that image, you'll potentially look at it and kind of like become fascinated by it. So what's happening is the other's desire is solidifying your desire for yourself.
Yeah. Oh, what a nightmare. We're living in a constant nightmare. What is your takeaway?
Ooh.
Oh, I can hit one.
You do a takeaway for it. Yeah, I have to think about it.
This is good. I like it. I feel like I enjoyed the story a lot. I enjoy the Phyllis.
Yep.
Out to get. I'm a little confused as to why it was all those characters. You know, Phyllis and then Aristotle and then Alexander the Great. It's really interesting, but yeah. It's fun when those stories. It's like it sounds like Picasso, the Le Pan et Gilles. Do you know what that is?
No.
I think it's like I want to say it's a Steve Martin play, but it's about Picasso and Einstein. And I don't remember who else. Who do we got? Okay, Lee. All right. I get it. But anyway.
You're wanted at the Valley Folk.
I think I'm wanted, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I'm probably going to be told to grab something. Five messages? Two messages? Too much? Too much, guys. Wow. The whole phone. Anyway. So, yeah, so I think we're on the right track. I think I'm on the right track. And I think that the moral of the story here, it seems, is both that there is something that will always get through to you. When it does, it's okay. Control it. You can do it, process it, and deal with life in the midst of whatever your weakness is. Maybe, but I still don't quite know what mine is.
Yeah.
With the exception of like obvious ones.
And maybe in light of what you're saying, I'm going like, maybe, you know, the idea of weakness is the object A is what makes us weak at the knees. It's what gets us to kind of like, as I say, potentially break our social reality, etc. But and maybe it's only a weakness when it's unhealthy, like when we feed it in an unhealthy way, when we try to resist it, when we try to fight it, then we get into this really unhealthy thing. But if you're able to integrate that, the idea is not to get rid of it, but to integrate your weakness, to not see it as a weakness. That's probably the trick. The trick is to see your weakness isn't a weakness, to work it through, to try to integrate it into your life. And there'll still be some, because it's love. This, what we're talking about is love.
Yeah.
Love is the excessive attachment to some object.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of fun like terms that kind of dance around really what we're talking about, and that would be it. I mean, there's also the element, like love is one, and it's also the term that my therapist used was like, and it took forever for us to get to this point, because when I started therapy, I was so obsessed with being very like, you know, I'm nice guy, go along, get along, Elliot. And then the term he used was like, there's that, but there's also this like gorilla inside of you that like is that you're pretending isn't there in these actions. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's very true. And it's like the gorilla part of me, or the part of me that's just this sort of like animalistic whatever, is not something that is necessarily like destructive until I allow it to be destructive, and it can become destructive when I pretend it's not there.
Yeah, and that's another good example of object A. When someone throws dishes, whenever someone explodes in anger, when they're normally, say, a nice gentle person, there's something about the A that's being triggered. Something as fundamental is happening, but that hasn't been integrated into their lives.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine who I consider to be one of the greatest, most gentle, sweetest people in the world, the person who will absolutely and has very much just laid down his life, his circumstances, preferences for other people. And it's the only person I know who I've ever seen multiple times punch a wall.
Oh yeah.
My dad, like, go for it, man.
My dad's the most chilled out man I've ever met. He is so zen. But I still remember one day when he chased some of my brother's friends down the street with an axe.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I think it was more to freak them out than anything else, but he did. Like, for one of the few times I ever saw him explode, they were all pretty crazy, but he literally picked up an axe and chased him down the street.
That's great. Anyway, I guess that concludes it for us. I don't want this to cut off, you guys, so it's a little bit shorter. It's about 45 minutes. Thank you for listening. If you want to get tickets to the live show, go to peterrollins.com under events. We're also tweeting about it, and follow Pete on Instagram. It's Peter Rollins. I'm Elliot Morgan on Instagram, and there'll be advertisements there as well.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.